I told the students from Drew that this just fits right in with the feeding of the 5,000 families. So that my experience of being on a delegation was really pivotal in my coming to terms with my calling as a pastor. And there on a delegation, some of them, I would say maybe even most of them, in their first year of seminary. So this is a really important time of heartbreaking open, a time of seeing and tasting and smelling and hearing what the kingdom of God feels and sounds and looks like. I had an experience leading a delegation when I was a missionary in Chiapas. I often hosted delegations that came down from the United States. This was from the Illinois and Wisconsin conferences of the United Church of Christ, who worked very closely with me in helping to fund projects in Chiapas in the Catholic Diocese of San Cristobal, but also coming on delegations and going and seeing Christ across the border and then carrying the gospel of Chiapas back to their communities. And many of them really profoundly changed their lives, their jobs, and their churches and made a big impact on their communities. One such delegation was a group that came down to investigate a cattle cooperative that was in San Caralampio, which is a very remote village. So the folks from Wisconsin and Illinois had been working with another community in Chiapas that was very impoverished, trying to help prevent immigration, and they wanted to go and see this cattle collective that was in San Caralampio. So we had some buses and trucks, and we rode over the bumpy roads, and then we walked into the community of San Caralampio, where we would see this cattle collective. So I'm the interpreter, right, and I'm also the delegation leader, and there's, you know, lots of people, and this very rural indigenous community, very impoverished, very proud of their cattle. And upon our arrival, this little girl kind of adopted me, and she came up and took my hand, and she had a traditional scarf around her head, and she had on the traditional dress, and she was profoundly deaf. She couldn't speak. She just held my hand and stood there. And so while I translated, Veronica was right there holding my hand. And when it got time to go up to the cattle collective, we had to go up this, felt like a mountain. It was really slippery. It had been raining, and I had on sandals, and we're walking up this hill, and Veronica's like, she's like this big, you know, and she's hauling me up the hill and holding my hand, of course, never saying a word. We get up to the top, and I'm interpreting about the cattle cooperative, and the cattle are doing what they do, making the messes that they make, and I'm holding my pants up, trying to not let it get on my pants, and Veronica's holding my hand. And as we walk down the mountain, there's this fan out of children walking with me and Veronica holding my hand and then all the adults of the community and the folks from Wisconsin and Illinois. And we got down to the bottom and they had a meal prepared for us and they sat us down at this big table and we had corn on the cob. And if you've ever eaten corn on the cob in Mexico, it's tough. It's big and it's like a meal. So that's all we had, and they served us, and we had 2 ears because we thought that's all the food we'd have that day. We had 2 ears. But then they brought the chickens that they'd killed and the tortillas they'd made by hand and other things that they had prepared, beans, and we looked around, and we were the only ones eating. They weren't eating. They were waiting for us. And I said to the person who was our person in the community, I said, we can't eat without the community eating with us. And he said, oh no, hermana, he said, you have to eat. This is our hospitality to you. And what is left, we will eat and we'll be happy for it because it will be more and better than what we normally eat. So we very self-consciously continued to eat, leaving as much as we possibly could after eating 2 huge ears of corn. And every once in a while, Veronica would come and sit next to me. And then she'd go back over. The women were sitting over here and the men over here because that's what they do in that community. And when we left and we had to walk out on the rutted roads, Veronica walked us halfway to the truck. And she looked up at me and I looked down at her and I felt, I'm a woman, empire-born, educated, everything that they long to be in some strange way. And she chose me to hold my hand and take me up to that mountain to sit with me while I ate, bring me back down the mountain. That was feast one. The second feast is Herod's feast, which is filled with beautiful women and powerful men and drama and intrigue and bitterness and paranoia and revenge. Herod, the ruler of Judea, became paranoid when he heard about Jesus, and he thought that Jesus was John, risen from the dead. He was very paranoid about that. Text tells us that it was on account of Herodias. Of course, it's always the woman's fault in scriptures. The wife of his brother Philip, whom Herod had married, that he arrested John and brought him in chains. While Herod was fearful of John and the miracles he heard John had done, he was enraged by John's criticism of his marrying Herodias, who had been his brother's wife. He had had his brother killed to marry his wife, whose name, interestingly enough, I wonder if she changed it, was Herodias and his was Herod. But anyway, that's another sermon. And so he was angry and a vengeful man. What we have is a feast where we see the love of power. So Herod gave himself an extravagant birthday feast of food and wine and dancing girls. And I imagine after he was sated on fine wine and rich food and Herodias' daughter's sensual dancing, he swore to give her anything she wanted. And she said she wanted his head on a platter brought to her. Debbie Thomas of Journey with Jesus writes, "What bothers me about John the Baptist's death, its gruesomeness notwithstanding, is its utter senselessness. John dies at the whim of a clueless teenager. He dies because a powerful woman has a callous heart and a lustful man has a shallow sense of honor. He dies for moral cowardice. He dies for a dance. In other words," she goes on to write, "John is one of those people, and we all know them, who does everything right and then suffers anyway. You know what I mean? Worse, he dies disillusioned and afraid and unsure of his Messiah. Worse still, he suffers a death that accomplishes nothing, or so he might think. No one is saved, no one is converted, no one finds justice or mercy as a result of his execution. He goes to his death thinking that, as Teresa of Avila purportedly told God, quote, 'Lord, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few,'" end quote. By the way, in 39 AD CE, Herod was accused by his nephew Agrippa of conspiracy against the new Roman emperor Caligula, who sent him into exile, where he died utterly alone. He got his just rewards. So we can think of that in these times when people are screaming at each other, not listening at all, hurling words and heads on platter are a commonplace thing. Feast 3, the power of love. The feeding of the 5,000 families occurs in all four Gospels, so we can be pretty sure that that really happened. In John's version of the story, it was a child. John writes, "Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, 'Here's a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far will they go among so many?'" This is a profoundly different kind of meal and table than the one we heard from in this morning's gospel of Herod's feast. Herod's was a meal to display his love of power. It was a different meal than the one we hear of in Jesus' ministry. Different hungers, different expressions of power and community. There was feeding at Herod's feast, but it was not blessed or blessing, quite the opposite. Herod's meal was motivated by fear and the love of power, and Jesus's was motivated by compassion and the power of love. I want to say something about that child from John's gospel. The children at the border certainly come up with their tortillas, and if you've ever been out in the desert, you can see the remnants of the food that they eat, often tuna cans and tortillas. And I think about all the children waiting in line, seeking asylum at the border today, who've come to share the little that they have in the hopes of sharing the abundance of what we have. And I think about compassion fatigue. I wrote on my Facebook page this week that every day my heart is broken these days, and it's hard to get up and go on, and it's hard to come before you and find a word that is compelling and inspiring and hopeful. And sometimes I think we move too quickly to hope when terrible things happen. I remember in my own lifetime the lynching of Emmett Till. And while my family reacted that in a very different way than I would as I grew into an adult, it was a horrific thing for a young child to hear. And then there were the assassinations of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and the Kennedys and Romero, Archbishop Romero, and the 4 church women in El Salvador, and on and on and on and on and on. And every day there's something new. And it's discouraging and it's depressing. And we who are very committed and involved in following Jesus get really tired. And sometimes compassion fatigue looks like we don't really care for this moment. Sometimes it means we eat or we sleep or we drink or we do too much or we don't do anything at all. Sometimes it looks like in rage, we take our anger inward and we become terribly depressed. And sometimes it's outrage and we gather with community to make a difference in the world. I think about how to minister in a time when compassion fatigue is an everyday phenomenon. And I was asked by the Drew folks, you know, how we did this, how we made church in a time when our people are so divided, how we were a light in the world when it's so hard to be that and so threatening and so risky. And so I told him about the building blocks of our community, how we are intentionally being the church, as our banners say up here, all the time in everything we do in our groups, in our mission trips, in our spiritual direction groups, in all of our small group gatherings, in our volunteering, in everything we do, in our outreach to the community. A year ago, we decided to offer a feast in a way that we hadn't before, and that is by sharing our incredible facility here with someone who needed space, someone who had an urgent need, who was at risk and vulnerable, and would be separated from his children if we didn't act right away. Very quickly, the church mobilized. We equipped a room with beds and a TV and a refrigerator and everything that that person might need. We made the stairway to heaven, I call it, a shower that saved us about $5,000. You have to go up steps to actually take a shower so that we could hook into a pipe that was already in the wall. We made a space, and then we found our family. And they joined the church, and they've loved our church. And they've become part of our family, and they will always be no matter what. 9 months they've been here, and they are family with us. And I remember when we were voting on it, and a lot of people were saying, so this is what we're going to do, and this is such a good thing that we can do, and really focusing on being Jesus. And finally, Karen McDonald said, well, I wonder how it's going to change us. This is how it's changed us. We're more joyful. We're more committed. We know the human face of Christ on the border. We want to be more bold and take deeper steps into ministry, right? We show up because a large part of being a Christian is showing up every day, whether we want to or not. So today we celebrate the fourth feast, which is a feast with a family that we so love, a feast with our church family, and we will be bringing a new person in some one way or another, to be family, and we will continue on and on and on with the feast that Jesus invites us to, the feast that Jesus invites us to be, being the hands and feet and body and breath of Jesus Christ in the world today. Amen.